Good morning. And welcome to week five. Week five out of a plan six on life after death. I'll ask people to please silence their phones. I'd like to avoid using the microphone if I can. That doesn't make that much of a difference, no. The microphone creates such an odd echo. I'd like to avoid that if I can. Something like that. Probably a nicer image, though, for it. Couple of things. First of all, as I announced last week, I gave out flyers then, but we ran out of flyers and printing more. But we have the big program coming up on December 25th. The Tanakh in a Day, or specifically Failure in Tanakh, Tanakh Book of Failure. It is a free program, runs from 9 o'clock until 4:30 in half-hour increments. So you do not need to come for the entire day, although you are welcome to do so. There is a free dairy lunch. Does require signing up online. I expect, send out the details in the email follow-up from the session later today. So you should see it there. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's my home Beit Midrash, where I spend time when I'm not, here at Yeshivat Or Chaim, the corner of Almore and Faywood. I also want to take the opportunity to mention two other things. One, as we draw towards the end of this series, so my next series, God willing, is going to start in February. You get a January break, and we'll have a short series in February. It's called something like Kosher Cops. I don't remember exactly what we called it, but it's about the Jewish ethics of police work. And something very different from the whole life after death discussion. More in terms of ethical dilemmas, issues of use of force, issues of carding, things like that. It should be interesting. I'm hoping it'll be interesting because I have to sit through it. So that'll be in February. And then, God willing, in March, April, we'll have a series from Rabbi Sammy Bergman. Rabbi Bergman is here today. He's sitting back there very quietly. He is the new Sgan, which is to say the sort of deputy head of my Beit Midrash. And he will be giving a class. We haven't actually figured out what the topic is yet, but that'll be Purim Passover time, so it's a good bet that it'll relate to that. You'll get more information about that, God willing, as the date comes closer. So, at this point, we have gone through logical arguments as well as textual evidence for the existence of life after death in Jewish thought. And then we moved from that to talk about the specifics. So what does life after death look like? And we talked about the fact that all of the descriptions that you find in the biblical text really are very general. They don't give us a lot of detail at all of what's coming, just that the soul does survive death. And the rabbis have descriptions of judgment. They have descriptions of places of reward, descriptions of places of punishment. And we asked, how did they get that from the biblical text? And we showed they build it on particular verses. But fundamentally, what they're doing is really a function of two strands of evidence. Number one, they build it on logic, which is to say, Judaism teaches about responsibility to follow certain commands and not to transgress in certain ways, and it describes reward and punishment, and we really don't see that play out in this world. It's very hard to see how a person's deeds correspond with whatever happens to them. And so the conclusion is, well, it must be that that's what happens in the next world. There must be a judgment, there must be reward, there must be punishment. That's one strand. And then the other is that there are some biblical texts, as we saw last week, that actually do speak of reward and punishment that is after death, and that's what this builds on. So they come up with, again, based on verses, ideas of, on the one hand, reward, on the other hand, punishment. And in both of them, we noted that there are elements evidence of some kind of spiritual component. So the reward being proximity to God, participation in a heavenly study hall, which looks a lot like this with all the Hanukkah decor on the tables. And then in the place of punishment, it's a distancing from God, a karet, a cutting off. And then on the other hand, we said that in terms of the of both sides, there is some kind of quasi-physical experience of reward and quasi-physical experience of punishment, which is never made entirely clear, except that we had a description of how in this place of reward, people have homes that are suited for their level, whatever that means. What good is a home if you're just a soul? There must be some kind of enjoyment that comes with that. As well as in the place of punishment, a reference to fire we saw in one Talmudic source. And we explained that this is predicated on the idea which we saw in the Talmud, the story of the two guards, right? The two guards in the orchard. What was the story with the two guards? You remember? Right, one is not able to see and one is not able to walk, right? Which is a really good idea when you hire guards for your orchard. That's really, you know, they went looking for that. And they hire the two of them to guard the orchard, and the two of them get a bright idea, right? One of them says, I can see the fruit on the trees, but I can't get to them. And the other one says, well, I can get to them, but I don't know where them is, are. So they work together. The one who is not able to see puts the other one on his shoulders and is directed as to how to get to the fruit, and that's how they get the fruit. And when the owner of the orchard comes back and says, where's my fruit? And the blind one says, I don't know what you're talking about. And the one who can't walk says, well, I couldn't have gotten it. So he realizes what happened, and he says, I'm putting the lame one, the one who can't walk, on the shoulders of the blind one, and I'm going to punish them together. I'll whip them together. And the message is, the body is not able to do anything without the soul. The soul is not able to do anything without the body. The two worked together in this world to accomplish whatever they accomplished for good or otherwise. And therefore, the reward and punishment have to correspond. There have to be elements of both. And we tied that back into what we said in the first week, where we said that the goal, or the second week, we said the goal of life is to learn to put the ethical ahead of the instinctive desire for pleasure. That's what we're supposed to be doing here in this world, is learning to put the ethical imperative, what God has told us is good, to put that pursuit ahead of the pursuit of pleasure. And so if a person says, that's what I'm going to do, and that's the way they live their lives that way, then God says, okay, then the pleasure that you chose to skip in this world, I'm going to make sure you don't miss out. And that's what you will receive on a physical and spiritual level in the next world. And unfortunately, if a person went the other way with it and decided to pursue pleasure instead of the ethical imperative, then that has to be taken care of as well in the next world. That's just a 5-minute condensation of what we've seen. Now we get to some weird stuff. That's a good title, I think. That's better than the title on the source sheet. I should have done that. I thought I was being clever, right, with the alliteration on the top of the source sheet, alternative endings, awareness in the afterlife. I thought that was pretty good, but the truth is I could have just done weird stuff. And sometimes you get too clever. Because what we're going to talk about today, and those who have been at my Adath Israel classes, we discussed some of this, I don't know, a year or two ago, maybe three. What we're going to talk about today are, as I put it, alternative endings. Meaning, we talked about Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, for pleasure. We talked about Gehinom, right? This idea of a hell-like place, which someone emailed me after the class to ask, is this where the Christians get the idea of purgatory? Because we noted that within Judaism, we're taught that the experience in Gehinom is actually temporary, and there's a re-judgment. And the answer is probably yes. That probably is where they got purgatory. Most of their ideas, if not all of them, are rooted in something that they got from us. So yes, that as well. But now we're going to talk about two other possibilities. None of the above, so to speak, called limbo. And I'm associating that with something called the dibbuk. How many people here are familiar with the concept of a dibbuk? Okay, a fair number of, uh, of, uh, of people are aware of the Dybbuk. And then the idea that is called Gilgul, or in full, Gilgul Neshamot. In English it is called? Reincarnation. Thank you, Sarah. Reincarnation. So, like I said, weird stuff. We're going to talk about those two elements, and if we get through that, we will also talk about one of the classic questions, which is, do people who have passed away know what's going on in this world? Yes. So Marilyn says yes, which is great, because now I can spend more time on the other two elements. I like it. No, I think a clear, definitive answer is the way to go. Totally in Judaism. So if you take a look at the first source, going back to the Dybbuk and the idea of specifically possession, this comes from Josephus Flavius. Josephus Flavius is a very, very interesting historical figure. He was Jewish. He was the head of a garrison of soldiers fighting the Romans. And he gave up his garrison to the Romans. But there's a particular story about how he gave up the garrison, which I learned when I was in computer science, of all things. You see, there's something called the Josephus algorithm. Is that familiar at all? No. Great, I can make it up. No, the Josephus algorithm is this. The idea is that Josephus has his soldiers in their fortress, and the Romans are closing in, and they know it's only a matter of time, and they start thinking like Masada. Right? They're just going to execute themselves. But the question is, who is going to shoot whom, so to speak? And so what they come up with is a plan. They're all going to sit in a circle, and then each one is going to kill somebody. It's like the next person over to their right. And that's the way they're going to do it until finally the last one left is going to have to kill himself. That's the plan. They execute the plan. And the one left alive is Josephus. And the question that we had in computer programming is, could you come up with a program that would create such an algorithm that would function in such a way that you guarantee that you're the last one alive? Because Josephus does not kill himself. He turns himself over to the Romans instead. And so the suspicion has been that he actually plotted this in order to survive. Be that as it may, that's the Josephus algorithm. You could, you can use that somewhere in conversation, I'm sure. Josephus joins the Romans and writes a history of the Jews intended to try to curry favor with the Romans. So he's going to omit anything that makes it look like Jews are trouble. Right? He doesn't want the Romans to feel like they have to now get rid of Josephus as well as the rest of the Jews. But he gives an account of our history and some Jewish practices as well. And here you find in his work, Antiquities of the Jews, he's talking about King Solomon. And he says, God also enabled him, meaning Solomon, to learn that skill which expels demons, which is a science useful and sanative to men. Sanative, like healthy, I guess. He composed such incantations also by which distempers are alleviated. And he left behind him the manner of using exorcisms, by which they drive away demons so that they never return. And this method of cure is of great force unto this day. I have seen a certain man of my own country, whose name was Eleazar, releasing people that were demoniacal in the presence of Vespasian, the Roman emperor, and his sons, and his captains, and the whole multitude of his soldiers. So, Josephus says that in the time of King Solomon, they are exorcising people. Now, Solomon is credited, in classic sources, with serious mystical knowledge. The Talmud discusses that. But the question I think that you have to ask is this a Jewish thing? Is Josephus actually recording a Jewish tradition? Because exorcism, the idea that somebody might be possessed, not by a demon, the demons are a whole other story. That's not a life after death class, that's a something else class. But the idea that, as also included within this, that a soul of somebody who lived and passed away might actually inhabit somebody else's body doesn't fit into the Garden of Eden and Gehenna models that we've talked about. So I'll ask you, is the idea that somebody who passed away might come back and inhabit the body of somebody else. Is that Jewish?
No.
I've got no's over here. Moish?
Yes.
Moish says yes. Why yes? Just to be contrary.
But look, as long as you're upfront about it.
Diane.
Not that I'm familiar with. He's in every hotel room. Right at the beginning of Bible.
No, Gideon does not return. Okay. Hang on, I see a few hands. I'm going to take, Ruchama, Barbara, and then Moshe. Yeah.
I think that they asked this in the first time, that if all the, when everybody sleeps, and the neshama lays in,
yes,
they can get kablonjit when they come back and go into another one.
Right.
And that's why we say in the morning,
right. So we're going to come back. As Ruchama suggests, that maybe it's not about a soul coming back into another body after death, but maybe it's actually a soul that left the body when the body was sleeping, and then entered somebody else that got verblunden. So this only happens to Ashkenazi, Ashkenazi souls. But it got verblunden and it ended up in the wrong person. So we're going to actually come back to that idea. Hold your thought on that one. Barbara.
Well, I'm thinking about the Diggle, and if I have my own neshama, and then this other soul comes in, is that another one taking over from my...
That's what it sounds like, no?
Yeah, that's what
it sounds like something else is now in the driver's seat, so to speak.
So pushing mine out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, since they're both non-physical, it's not so much an issue of space. But yeah, taking charge and telling the other soul, sorry, occupied. That's what it sounds like.
Yes,
Moish.
I actually believe that. I wasn't trying to comfort. I believe that we've never seen Kol Yisrael Arayim Shalosh.
Yes.
That's a very small model. I think beyond the world we want, like Kol Yisrael Arayim Shalosh. There's a high
So Moshe floats the idea. We have a principle within Judaism that all of us are mixed together with each other. We have a joint and mutual responsibility for each other. There is a connection. And he suggests on a spiritual level that could be so. I still don't think that leads you to possession. Because you can be close to somebody but not steal their house. Right. So what I'd like to do is suggest the following. The Dybbuk, I believe, is not naturally, inherently a Jewish idea. It's something that was found in cultures around us. However, it is similar enough to certain ideas that are found in Judaism that it finds a home in Judaism as well because of that similarity. And specifically, I want to talk about the idea which we've referenced a couple of times of limbo. Go back to that classic line which I quoted at the end of our first week, the beginning of our second week, from Abigail, the blessing and curse that she issued to King David. She said that his soul should be bound up in the bond of life, connected to lives, which we talked about last week, as part of that spiritual connection in the Garden of Eden. But she also had the curse. She said that the souls of his enemies should be cast in some kind of catapult or slingshot or something along those lines. What that suggests is the idea of limbo. The idea of a soul that doesn't have a place to rest. That can be expressed in one of two ways. Either reincarnation, it has to come back to this world, or limbo. Take a look at the second source on the sheet, where you find a defense of the idea of reincarnation, which we're going to come back to, but I'm presenting this here first because it is linked to that biblical verse from Abigail. Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra was a major authority in Jewish law, as you see here in the 16th century in Spain and then in Israel. And he's asked the following question. The following midrash is hard for us to understand. This is a midrash we've already quoted. The souls of the righteous and the souls of the wicked alike return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world. As it is written, may the souls of your enemies be slung in the bowl of the sling, in the catapult. So the midrash says, as I underlined, not only do the wicked come back to go through this catapult, but the righteous as well. So he says, that's the opposite of our tradition. We're taught that the righteous have a place to rest. Further, the proof brought applies to the wicked one's soul. The verse that they're quoting from Abigail is a curse that she gives to the enemies of King David. It's not for the good guy. Why should the righteous one's soul be buffeted about? What is his source? That's the question that's put to Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra. He was probably thinking at this point, couldn't they just have stuck the dairy spoon in the meat pot and asked me that question instead? Right? This is not one of those I was trained in rabbinical school to answer. But no, he's very brave. He says, indeed, we find that Rabbi Eliezer said the opposite in the Talmud, the opposite of what was quoted in the question. He says, the souls of the righteous, we've seen this source as well, are stored under the divine throne as it is written, may my master's soul be bound in the bond of life, and the souls of the wicked are buffeted below as it is written, may the souls of your enemies, and so on. He says, the truth of the matter is, you're right. What I've learned is that the righteous are in the Garden of Eden, and the wicked may have to go through the whole, roller coaster. However, know that there are righteous people who receive as do the wicked in this matter, such as those who stumbled in a sin which mandates reincarnation until they fulfill the divine will according to his justice. And he quotes you a verse from Samuel, he, God, devises plans lest anyone be pushed away. Thus that midrash said, the souls of the righteous which need this and the souls of the wicked return, descend, are buffeted about in the world, dot, dot, dot. In other words, he says, when the Talmud describes limbo, when Abigail talks about a catapult, they're talking about reincarnation. The idea that some souls go to the Garden of Eden, some souls go to Gehenna. You notice I switch sides now. Garden of Eden was this way, Gehenna is that way. Equal opportunity, right? And then you have reincarnation. That's what he conceives of as limbo. And what's the goal of reincarnation according to this? What's the what are you trying to accomplish? He says it. To get to
the Garden of Eden.
But what has to happen? Learning. You have to be good. You have to correct the wrong. There was something that was done wrong that has to be corrected. I'm going to come back to that. We're not yet ready for reincarnation, so to speak. But that's one version of what this limbo thing is. Here's the other version. Rabbi Udalo, in source number 3, he is better known, as I put in the parentheses, as the Maharal. Anyone know what the Maharal of Prague is most famous for not doing? Sorry? The golem, right. The contention is that he created a golem. It's there in the Al-Noishul up in the attic, don't disturb, right? To defend the Jewish community there. I find the evidence for the golem to be questionable. Leave it at that. Nonetheless, it's a very good thing to have on your resume that people think you created that. With the construction noise, do you think I need to go with the mic? Is that, no? You sure? Okay. All right. If it becomes a problem, please say so. I'd rather that people be able to hear. So the Maharal is a very serious mystic. Aside from being an expert in the laws of the Torah, aside from being an expert in Talmud, he is a serious mystic. And he describes a limbo type of experience. He says the wicked person goes to extremes in his deeds. The opposite of a righteous person who does not stray from the straight path and the middle point. He believes that extremes are negative. Right? It's a Maimonidean idea. It's before Maimonides. Go back to Aristotle, golden mean. You're supposed to try to have a moderate path, and then you have people who go to extremes. And he says, because of that, because the wicked person goes to extremes, a malach. Malach is a servant of God, angel, whatever you want to term you want to use, stands at one end of the world, and another one at the other end. Just as he, the wicked person, notice he's always a male, went from one extreme to the other. There are two extremes. So he has no rest. For as you will know and understand with deep wisdom, the extreme has no rest. Therefore, the Malach who stands at one end does not accept him, for he is associated with the extreme, and so he slings him to the second extreme. Quite the experience. A cosmic or celestial game of ping pong, basically, in which you learn your lesson for having gone to extremes in this world. You like extremes. I'll show you extremes. And then that's what they have to experience, is some kind of limbo. They do not have a place of comfort. They do not have a place to rest. But instead, they go back and forth and back and forth. Are we clear on that? I mean, as clear as you're going to get about something that's so difficult to understand. So, that I think... Yes, Jack. Jack?
Is this supposed to be for eternity, or is there a finite period?
You know, it doesn't say. Question's a good question. Is this eternal, or is this finite? My guess would be finite. My reasons for saying finite are, number one, because we talked about last week, the idea of periodic judgment of those who have passed away. And it's possible that they go through this for a period, and then you've learned your lesson, purified, and then move on. Number two, though, because you'd have all sorts of issues of space junk and collisions if there were too many of them. Like, you have to clear out the space. That's a joke. I think like the description of the Garden of Eden, well, like the description of Gehinnom, it's also something that is a temporary experience. That would be my assumption. Ricky, and then Eddie, yeah.
Could she be writing this as another Musar to frighten people more than what she has, and what she has, and all of that? Or is she actually saying what things happen?
That's a good question. Ricky asks the question. Is this just an attempt to frighten people and get them to do what they're supposed to do? Or does he really think this is where things were going? The truth of the matter is that there were works written historically that were intended to take, so to speak, the worst case scenario and describe the worst things in order to get people to go straight, in order to get people to stick to what they're supposed to do. However, I don't think that's the case here, because he's doing it as a basic explanation of that passage in the Talmud that talks about the souls being slung, which comes from Abigail's verse. So this is very textually linked, and that's why I think that it's actually meant on a as literal a level as something could be understood. Eddie,
I'm not quite clear. The ones that are being slung,
So that is exactly where I'm going with this. So thank you. They keeping me on track. I think that this concept of limbo. I had asked for permission a couple of weeks ago for someone to take a picture or two. So Rabbi Bergman is going to take care of that. Please don't look like you're learning any more than you were a minute ago. Okay. So what I would like to suggest is that the idea of a dibbuk finds its home within Judaism because of this idea of limbo, of being unrooted, that is found classically. I mean, the Talmud does not mention anything about somebody's soul coming back to inhabit somebody else's body. You can look high and low. You ain't going to find it. It's not there. But there was an idea in the ancient world, and I brought you in source number 4, a piece related to ancient Egypt. I'm not going to read it out loud here. You can see it later. We have enough Jewish stuff to learn. But in ancient Egypt, they're talking about possession already. And Jews come to recognize it at some point. The word dibbuk itself is drawn from the Hebrew. I gave it to you in source number 5. The Hebrew letters, Dalet, Bet, Kuf, Davek, means what? It's a stick, right? In kindergarten, they gave us Devek, right? Was the word for paste. It's something that sticks. That's what a dibbuk is. So, what Jews did is to take this idea and see it in the context of this idea that not everybody goes to the Garden of Eden, not everybody goes to Gehenna. Some people are in limbo, and maybe in limbo they go looking for a place to be and they find somebody's body. You follow? That's the idea, I think. And lest one think it stays on the fringe, it doesn't stay on the fringe. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Rabbi Yaakov Chaim Sofer, he's a rabbi in Baghdad, the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. And he was discussing a set of blessings that are recited in the morning, including a blessing in which a Jew thanks God for making them a Jew or not making them a non-Jew. That's a whole discussion in its own right, not for right now. There's a blessing also for not having been made a slave. And yes, there's a blessing that males recite of, thank you for making me a male. And women say, thank you God for making me according to your will, meaning you got it right with me. There's a whole other discussion that I would love to have at some point, but it's not going to fit into this session right now, about what's behind that. There's a lot of surprising history that intertwines with early Christianity, which is just fascinating. So we'll have to do it at some point. But take a look at source number 6, where Rabbi Sofer says, you know why you say those blessings in the morning? It's a little odd, right? Every morning I'm going to thank God once again for making me this and not making me that. He says, no. And this goes back to what Ruchama was talking about. It is also possible to explain that during one's lifetime, one might become pregnant, so to speak, with one of these. You might gain one of these other souls. Each night, one's soul gives an accounting before its creator and is judged for its deeds. Sometimes they will give it another soul in what's called sod ha'ibur, the secret of pregnancy. Meaning, yeah, I know, pregnancy is an odd term, isn't it? But that's the idea. He says you're making this blessing to thank God for putting you back into you and not giving you a passenger. Or making you a passenger, I suppose. Going back to Barbara's question about who's in control at this stage. So, my point in quoting this is not to say that that's the source for making these blessings. We have plenty of other explanations for these blessings. However, this is fundamentally a work of Jewish law. And he's very comfortable bringing the idea of a dibbuk in a Sephardi land, by the way, in Baghdad, where they wouldn't have called it a dibbuk at all. Right, that they're not Yiddish speakers. But talking about that as part of the person's experience. Sorry, he called it pregnancy, ibur. Right, that's the term that he's using. So what I'm suggesting again, just to make sure this is clear, is the dibbuk idea is not found, as far as I can tell, anywhere in Tanakh scripture. Anywhere in the Talmud. It is an idea that Jews encounter, and it can be seen as consistent with the idea of a posthumous limbo experience. The soul is wandering, it hasn't gone to the Garden of Eden, it hasn't ended up in Gehenna, it's in this catapult, and maybe at some point it's stuck into a body. It's an odd idea, to say the least. I don't think that one needs to accept this as part of Judaism. That brings us to, yeah.
Okay, so I keep having two ideas go through my mind. One is the concept of deja vu.
Yes.
And the other one is of schizophrenia.
Oh, boy. So two ideas were mentioned. One, the idea of deja vu, and the other, the idea of schizophrenia. So, I'm going to stay away from the second one. In all seriousness, I'm going to stay away from the second one. It needs a longer treatment and a longer discussion that I could reasonably give it here, and it's too serious a topic for me to do lightly. The deja vu one, though, is going to feed into where we're going next. So that'll be a deja vu about deja vu, very meta. Because now we move into the second alternative ending, which is reincarnation. Now, again, I want to distinguish, as I did last week, between reincarnation and Tchiyat HaMeitiv, the resurrection of the dead. It is a fundamental Jewish belief and we'll talk about it, God willing, next week, that at some future date in a messianic time, the dead come back to this world, and there is this thing called Triat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. It is predicted in the book of Daniel, it is predicted in the book of Isaiah. We will talk about that. What we're talking about now, though, is not that. What we're talking about in reincarnation is the idea of transmigration of souls between people and even between species. So that a person dies and then they come back in a new life, maybe as a person, maybe as a fish. I'm not kidding. When I was learning in yeshiva in Israel, and there was a fellow who was in yeshiva with me who every time he saw a dog bark would say, machul lach. My Hebrew speakers, what does machul lach mean? You are forgiven. With the idea being that a person who spoke harmfully about others, a person who speaks Lashon Hara, would have to come back again as a barking dog. That's the punishment for what they did wrong in this world. So he was very forgiving. If you're ever sitting and studying and learning and there's a fly buzzing around, so it's there in order to learn. That sort of an idea. Yes?
I also heard that after eating fish, one should drink wine because the souls of Sadiqim are reincarnated into fish and you don't know who you're eating.
Oh boy! And so the wine serves what purpose exactly? How did the wine fit into that one? So the idea of drinking between fish and meat, as I understand it, is a very different idea. The Talmud talks about it being understood as a health hazard to cook fish and meat together. It was considered to be dangerous. And in order to make sure that no one would cook them together, they separate them out at the meal so that after fish, you clean your mouth out. You eat some bread, something, some starch to clean out your mouth. You take a drink. It does not need to be schnapps. It can be water just as much. And then you move on with your meal. But no, I never heard anything about it having to do with the souls of the righteous being in the fish. But we're going to talk about the fish. If you jump to number 7, you'll see it. We're not quite there yet because I saw two hands. There was a hand in that area. Yes. Yes.
And because what I learned, because the soul is coming back, probably coming back in that direction.
Okay, so we are going to come back to that, so hold on to that thought, but if you want to look ahead, you will find the number 8. That's going to lead us there, so just hang on to that thought. Marlene. Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
As you progress, you come back as a thought, and then you come back.
Right. Marlene points out that this sounds sort of like the Hindu idea of coming back in a hierarchy. Very much so. It absolutely does. And some are going to argue that they should have kept it, and that it's not ours at all. Let's go into some sources on this. This was a story, source number 7, from 2003. I remember this story so vividly when it happened. This was wild. The talking fish story. They made all around. This is an article from the New York Times about it. And so it came to pass that a talking carp shouting in Hebrew shattered the calm of the New Square fish market and created what many here are calling a miracle. Of course, others are calling it a Purim trick, a loopy tale worthy of Isaac Bashev, a singer, or just a whopping fish story concocted by a couple of Meshuggahs. This article is written by Corey Kilgannon. I don't know how many times he used the term Meshuggahs in his life before Corey Kilgannon wrote this story. But I brought you a piece of it here. You can find the whole thing online if you like, but basically the story goes that there was a non-Jewish fellow who was working in the fish market, and the fish that he was about to cut started speaking to him in Hebrew, and he calls over the Jewish manager of the fish store, and he says to the manager, "Sarich shmira, you have to protect yourself. Hasof ba, the end is coming." And then it goes on, as the story goes, that he says, Sarich tikun, he needs to be fixed, he needs something to be corrected about himself, and they should kill him and serve him at Shalosh Hodes. On Shabbos, and that way, that will be his tikun, that will be his repair. It's a bizarre story. No, I don't think that this was anything other than a prank. the question is this a Jewish idea? The idea that a soul could come back. The word in Hebrew for it, I used it before, is Gilgul. What's the origin, what's the etymology of the word Gilgul? To roll. Right, to roll around and around. Galgal is a wheel. The term Gilgul is rolling, kind of like the minutes on a month-to-month plan, right? So that would be this Gilgul. It's a very popular idea nowadays. People really like this idea, the idea of coming back again and again. I think it provides people with hope. It provides people with the belief that, you know, there's still another opportunity. But the question is this a Jewish idea, or, as this is Marlene said, a Hindu idea that has somehow been grafted into Judaism? What would you say? How many, just a quick show of hands, without explanations. How many people think that, and I won't judge you for it, that Gilgul is a Jewish idea? We got a couple of hands. That it's a non-Jewish idea. Definitely some more. On the fence. Okay, we got a bunch of on the fences as well. So, this is good. It means we have something to learn if you have that kind of a variety of views. There is nothing explicit in Tanakh, in biblical text, about it, although there are verses that people will interpret to refer to it, as we're going to see. It's not so surprising that it wouldn't appear in Tanakh, and that it wouldn't appear in the Talmud either, for that matter, because when you think about it, this is something that is mystical, and the mystical tends to stay out of the mainstream. But it's odd to see no reference. The term Gilgul shows up in three different Talmudic contexts. None of them have to do with reincarnation. They're about completely different things. They happen to use the word rolling, that's it. But the supporters of this idea say, wait a minute, we have biblical verses that can be read as leading in the direction of reincarnation. And the very first one on the list is indeed the one that's related to naming. It goes back to a mitzvah called Yibum. The Torah has a mitzvah which actually describes something done in general culture before the giving of the Torah. If a woman's husband passed away and there were no children, then the woman would have the opportunity to marry, in pre-biblical times, another male within the family, and then the Torah frames it as the brother of the deceased. The core idea seems to me to simply be about protection for the woman involved. It would be hard for her to be able to remarry, and she doesn't have any children to take care of her, and this way she will have marriage with somebody within the family. This goes back to the times of polygamy, so you know, they'd be able to have more than one wife, and she would be taken care of within the clan. It's not obligatory. She can refuse. He can refuse. There's a rite called chalitza that is performed to break the bond between the two of them. But that's the law in the books. That she would marry her brother-in-law, I should say. So take a look at source number 8, which comes from the biblical description of this practice. The firstborn child to whom she will give birth will stand on the name of the deceased brother. In the Hebrew, Yakum al Shem Achiv Hamet. Will stand on the name of the deceased brother. And his name will not be erased from Israel. Now, the literal read of that sentence, will stand on the name of the deceased, is that it's about the estate. Meaning, the deceased brother had assets. Those assets will go along with the widow to whoever marries the widow. He takes the place of the deceased. But look at this mystical text in number 9, in the Zohar. Right? We talked about the Zohar last year when we had our class on Kabbalah. The son is, the italics are mine, the son is the deceased man whose soul has returned to this world. Meaning, the son, the brother is the one who's taking over the estate, we mentioned that, but the son is going to be called in the name of the deceased. The son actually is a reincarnation of his mother's first husband.
What is this based on?
So that's what we have to ask, is where is this, what is this coming from? Remember, mystical tradition does not require logic, and does not require proof. Mystical tradition, by definition, doesn't need to answer to anybody. It says, this is what is so, God revealed it to us, and if you don't like it, too bad. That's the way mystics live with this sort of thing. However, we're going to come back to why it ends up becoming accepted within Judaism. Yes, Pearl.
But I was always brought up that if you named someone after someone that had died young, you then immediately gave them a second name to sort of... Someone who lived long.
Right. So I come back to the naming practice. This is a very particular context, but there is indeed an idea that you could name people for those who have passed on, and on a very literal, rational level, it is, I'm conveying a blessing to the child, and a wish that they should replicate the good traits of the person who passed away. However, yes, on a mystical level, there may be some kind of an association with their soul, the soul of the deceased, coming back. I should note that it's Ashkenazim who are hung up on naming for those who have passed away. Sephardim have no problem naming for the living, and that's the norm. They are naming for those who are still alive. For them, it's not a reincarnation thing, unless you want to go back to possession now, and maybe now you're grafting in the soul, whatever. But the idea that when you name for somebody, you're bringing back the soul is not necessarily. Doesn't necessarily need to be the way that naming for somebody is understood. It doesn't have to be understood as this kind of reincarnative practice, and it's often understood on a very simple level as you're blessing them to be like the person who passed away. And yes, there is the idea as well, as Pearl noted, if the person who you're naming for was someone who passed away under tragic circumstances, there's an idea of not giving exactly the same name. This is also true. But that's one verse that gets quoted to support the idea of reincarnation. The idea that this child born from Yibum is now somehow a reincarnation of the deceased. I'm looking and seeing the time, and that's why I'm going to shut down a little bit some of the questions at this point, so we can get through the material here. If you take a look at source number 10, there's another verse that gets quoted for this. The blessings that Moses gives to the tribes before he passes away. He says of the tribe of Reuven, Yechi Reuven v'al yamot. May Reuven live and not die. Which is a very odd turn of phrase. Normally, the two are mutually exclusive, right? May Reuven live. And go on. What is live and not die? So the reincarnation argument is, what he means is, he shouldn't have to come back to this world. May he live in the next world, and not have to die a second time. Related to certain events from the life of the biblical Reuven, which we're not going to be able to go into right now, but this view will say that reincarnation is a bad thing to experience, and the wish is Reuven should not have to go through this. There's another verse which I brought you from Job. I'm going to skip it just in the interests of time here. But you can see it in source number 11. This clearly doesn't have very strong biblical sources. But remember, when we talked about the Garden of Eden, and when we talked about Gan Eden, right, we also didn't have very strong sources. Right, we had verses that you could read to support it. The difference between that and this is, number one, in those cases, the argument that it was about the Garden of Eden or about Gehenna was Talmudic. It's an argument from a couple of thousand years ago that this is referring to Garden of Eden. These are authoritative sources within traditional Judaism. The argument that these verses are references to reincarnation have a much later and weaker pedigree. And so that's number one. Number two, I would argue these verses are less clear in terms of the idea that they're actually referring to reincarnation. And number three, reincarnation does not have the same logical pedigree within Judaism that the next world does. The idea of reward and punishment and so on, you don't have the same logical pedigree for it. What would be the argument that there should be reincarnation? If you wanted to say, logically, Judaism should believe in reincarnation, what would be the argument to support that?
To perpetuate goodness?
What does that mean, to perpetuate goodness?
If there's someone in particular who is so righteous, one hopes that it would be continued.
So I'm going to turn what Marilyn is saying a little bit. Marilyn says you'd hope that somebody who is good, somebody who is righteous, you could perpetuate the righteousness in this world by bringing them back.
Maybe it's the opposite.
Yeah, Betty?
Because if you get a second chance, it's a do-over.
Right.
It'd be better.
Another way to look at it would be a do-over. I'm going to come back to the do-over idea. But one of the classic arguments on behalf of belief in reincarnation is theodicy, which we've already talked about. The idea that we see people who do good things and yet suffer. We see people who do apparently very bad things and yet thrive. So, if there's a do-over coming, maybe they'll get what's coming to them. And not only that, but flip it, right? If you see somebody who's suffering in this world and doesn't seem to deserve it, maybe it's because of something that they did in a previous life. So you're taking the places of reward and punishment and bringing them into this world, effectively, by bringing them back for another run. Take a look at source number 12. Rabbi Eliezer Papo, in his work Pele Yoeks, made that argument. He says, through belief in reincarnation, one will also know that God's justice is true. God's deeds are perfect, for all his ways are just. One will not complain about God's actions as some fools do when they suffer, he says. He says, don't worry about it. Either it's because of something from the past, or it'll be reflected in something going forward. But it's a neat way, perhaps too neat way, to account for divine justice. That's Rabbi Papo's contention. It's not only his contention. Rabbi Sadia Gaon was, it may be said, the leading authority in the Jewish world in the end of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century Common Era. He was a giant in many different ways. And he took on this idea of Gilgul, of reincarnation, and said, quite scornfully, frankly, this is not a Jewish idea at all. He says, take a look at number 13. He's talking about people who believe in reincarnation, and he says, in their minds, this means that Reuven's spirit enters Shimon, and then Levi, and then Yehuda. Some, perhaps most of them, believe that a human soul may enter an animal, or an animal enter a human. The types of foolishness and confusion are legion. He was not a fan. He believed that you don't need this in order to solve the problems of faith. And he touched on the deja vu point as well. Meaning he went through a whole bunch of reasons why people believe in reincarnation. So he said people will observe that they see either a baby or they'll see an animal and it seems to exhibit traits that they remember from somebody who passed away. And therefore they will say, oh, it's this person coming back. He's not a fan. He points out that human beings look for patterns and we tend to see things where we wish to see them. And I think the deja vu piece of it may come into that. There's more science behind deja vu in terms of neural connections. But he's not convinced by any of that, and he thinks that it's not actually ours. Another argument on behalf of deja vu is simply the why not argument. If God could bring me into this world once, he could bring me back a second time.
Or a third.
Or a third, or a fourth, or however many times. It's the why not argument, to which the response is, yeah, but why do it? Just because you can? Rabbi Yosef Albo, in source number 14, in his Sefer HaIkarim, says, why should the soul, having served in a body, having experienced free will, went through this life, need to return to a body? Let it do it once, and be done with it. So you find arguments on behalf. You find attempts to anchor it in biblical texts. You find logical arguments of it accounts for reward and punishment. And then you find the opposition that says, yeah, but you don't need to resort to this, and it doesn't have the pedigree in Judaism that other ideas have. So you're at a stalemate. But what I find more interesting in this issue of Gilgul is not so much the question of, is it Jewish or is it not Jewish? As why one would come back. Two different schools of thought. Betty mentioned one school of thought. Maybe somebody did something wrong in the previous life. However, there are two ways that you can take that.
Take a look, please, at source number 15. Rabbi Eliezer Papo, we've already established as a believer in reincarnation. And he says, "The suffering of reincarnation is worse than death, worse than all the punishments of Gehenna, as the soul is reincarnated through the hierarchy of silent, growing, living, and speaking." This is a hierarchy of all that exists in our world. The lowest level is the domain, which is the mineral level. The silent, it doesn't speak. Then you have tzomeach, which is the plant kingdom that grows. Then you have chai, which is the animal kingdom. It's the living, so to speak, beyond growing, it moves around. And then medaber, speaking, is the human being. They are one who can communicate abstract thought through language. That's your basic hierarchy. And what Rabbi Papo contends is that that's what human beings actually go through, and it's a painful experience, he says. You don't want to be reincarnated, he says. He says reincarnation is a bad thing to have to go through. By the way, there's another biblical verse that this is based on. I didn't bring it on the sheet. It's based on a nuance in Hebrew. When God creates human beings, we actually read the verse the first week, he says they will rule over the fish, the birds of the heavens and the animals. The Hebrew is v'yirdu b'digat hayam uv'ov ha'shamayim uv'chol ha'chaya ha'romeset al ha'aretz. They are going to rule over v'yirdu all of these things. But with a shift of a vowel, v'yirdu becomes v'yirdu. They will descend. They will descend among the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea and the animals. That's another one that gets quoted as support for reincarnation. But going back to where we were, one argument is that reincarnation is about punishing a flaw. But there's a second argument. And the second argument is that reincarnation is actually about having opportunities to perfect our accomplishments. It feeds into it's the idea that, essentially, God gives us a whole range of mitzvot. It's really hard to fulfill all of them in this world. Someone pointed out to me after class, I think last week or the week before, it's actually physically impossible to fulfill all of them in this world, right? Because some of them require that you be a Kohen, a priest, right? Some of them require that you be a king. Some of them require men. Some of them require women. Within this idea, the soul will come back in different forms and have to live through all of these different experiences in order to perfect itself. Oh, that's hard. But take a look at source number 16. Source number 16 is part of this. It answers a question which I have heard asked at least twice so far in this series, which is, if you believe in reincarnation, then in the ultimate resurrection of the dead, Tchiyat HaMeitzim, which I mentioned before, which body comes back? Who are you married to? How does that work? And the Zohar explains that there are different parts of the soul. And different parts are perfected in different bodies. And his argument is, the last body in which the soul was planted and in which it grew successfully and developed good roots will rise up at that time. When you complete the task, that's your body. Now, we have to talk about that more next week when we talk about Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. Right now, our look at this is incomplete. But I'm going to use our last minute and 35 seconds to do a review as opposed to taking new questions. I'm still here afterwards for questions. We didn't get to the question of whether the dead are aware of this world. That's going to have to fit into next week's topic somehow. But what we've said is this. Aside from our review, we said the idea of exorcism, that a soul could inhabit somebody else's body, leaving aside demons, but a soul could actually come back and inhabit someone's body. Josephus seems to think that this is a Jewish thing, going back to King Solomon, this notion. The problem is it's not in biblical text, and it doesn't seem to be in classic rabbinic text either. It's not found in the Talmud. What we do have is a notion of limbo, though. Not in the Garden of Eden, not in Gehenna, but instead being catapulted, not having a place to rest. And the suggestion is that perhaps that resonates with people as a Dybbuk idea. Maybe the soul finds a body and jumps into it, and that would be a possession type of a scenario. And even though this isn't found classically, you find it make it into serious rabbinic texts in a more modern time, like the text I brought you about the blessings in the morning, thanking God for not putting a different soul into me. Second, we talked about this idea of reincarnation, whether people into a new body, a new human life, or whether people becoming animals, coming back in an animal form. And we said again, you don't find a clear biblical source for this idea. It's just not there. You do find verses that can be sort of, in a way, read that way. But we said that the logic behind it doesn't require reincarnation. The logic behind it of let's solve the problem of human beings suffering in ways they don't seem to deserve or receiving benefits they don't seem to deserve doesn't require a reincarnation idea. That doesn't mean it can't happen, but it means that it's not required by that. And Rabbi Sadia Gaon goes to town in general on the arguments on behalf of reincarnation and really didn't like it. But again, others disagree. The Zohar very clearly believes that there is such a thing as reincarnation, with the goal of it being either to punish a flaw, like Rabbi Papo wrote in number 15, or alternatively to give us an opportunity to fulfill all of the mitzvot and to perfect ourselves. We're going to have to continue next week and talk about awareness of the soul after a person passes away, and then the issue of Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. God willing, next week. I'm going to stay here and take questions and comments. Thank you very much. Thank you.